What we know from this study is that in this country, and we presume in other countries, if the study had been conducted there too, and more underway, industrial pollution begins in the womb. It begins in the womb before they even come into the world. And this is of personal importance to me now because I'm expecting my first child in June. This is an image, a sonograph of him. And we're, of course, very excited about that prospect, but share the worries that everyone who's been through this has, and maybe some more because of what we know about toxic chemicals. And he's precocious. So this is the story we want to emerge about babies coming into the world. We want it to be all about joy and learning and experience. We don't want them to come into the world pre-polluted, but unfortunately that's not the case. And these weren't just any chemicals that we found. We found that when we matched them up against databases of toxic effects collected from around the world, that 134 of them were shown to cause cancer in laboratory animals or in people. 151 were associated with birth defects in either laboratory studies or in people. 154 had the capacity to disrupt hormone systems. 186 associated with infertility. 130 that could disrupt or interfere with immune system function. And neurotoxins that we worry about, of course, because of the impact on the developing child's later ability to learn, to function in society, neurotoxins like lead and mercury and so forth, and many others that we found in this suite of chemicals of the 287. 158 had that effect. And that's what we found when we spent $10,000 per sample. If we had spent more, we might have found the kinds of numbers that the Centers for Disease Control and independent scientists have found. Who knows where this number might end up? Is it 300? Is it 400? Is it 500? Is it 600? No one really knows for sure because no one has done the study. More and more such work is underway. We've studied the pollution in air and water and land for decades, but we're only now beginning to study the pollution in people. But such low doses, many of the levels we found for many of these chemicals in the babies we studied were in the part per billion, very low levels. And we often hear from those who are concerned that these levels alone might cause panic or cause people to assume that the presence of a chemical is causing a disease, which of course we can never say. But it's also probably incorrect to say that low doses don't matter because they really can. And let me give you an example. A part per billion is the equivalent of one pancake in a stack of pancakes 4,000 miles high. That's a pretty low amount, I think we'd all admit. One pancake in a stack 4,000 miles high, that's a part per billion. What could possibly have a biological effect at such a low level? Reasonable question. Well, let's look at some results from a colleague of ours, a friend of ours we studied. We looked at his blood. His name is Jesse Johnson. He runs the Q Collection, a furniture company where they're trying to do everything right. They're trying to use fabrics that don't have chemicals on them that would linger in the environment, again, in people, plantation-grown wood. He's really sort of the Alice Waters of the furniture industry. I've actually eaten some of his smaller items, an ottoman, with some salsa, and it was fabulous. But Jesse had in his blood, when we tested it, 97.5 parts per billion of Badge 40H. Badge 40H is a breakdown product that comes off the lining of food cans. Fairly low level, 97 pancakes in a stack 4,000 miles high. He also had perfluorinated chemicals. These are the Scotchgard chemicals, the Teflon chemicals, the miracle chemicals that we've all known growing up by their trademarks and that are in all of us now. He had PFCs, as we call them, at 45 parts per billion, even lower. So we're really getting down there pretty far. What could possibly cause a biological effect at that level? Well, this was not found in Jesse. But this is the level in the blood after one dose of Cialis that produces its therapeutic effects. 30 parts per billion, one dose is all it takes to produce the desired therapeutic effect for Cialis. Paxil, the most common antidepressant on the market. Again, active. One dose, 30 parts per billion. So I hope you're beginning to get the idea that low doses can have profound effects if we study them. If we don't study them and don't know what's happening, we may never understand just what a low dose can do when it's an artificial chemical. He had lead at 21 parts per billion. We'd be more concerned about that if it was a small child. But still, we're getting down pretty low, and even lower. Mercury, 11 parts per billion. He's very concerned about mercury and the food he eats, aware of it in the environment. 11 parts per billion is a pretty low level. What could possibly cause an effect that low or even lower? How about the most common asthma ingredient, anti-asthma inhalant ingredient, that's in the desk of every school teacher in this country? Albuterol, 2.1 parts per billion, one dose with that asthma inhaler, has therapeutic effect. Going even lower, flame retardants, the polybrominated diphenyl ethers, the flame retardants we're all hearing about now. We found that at less than a third of a part per billion in Jesse Johnson's blood. And you might reasonably ask, what could possibly have a biological effect at one-third of a pancake in a stack of pancakes 4,000 miles high? Well, how about the most common contraceptive drug on the market? Active, one dose, almost 100% controlling, 0.035 parts per billion. So, low doses can matter. Let's review very quickly. For 30 parts per billion, you can inspire human reproduction. For 0.035 parts per billion, you can prevent it. And for another 30 parts per billion, you can feel fine about it either way. But even at low doses, some people are more vulnerable. And this is a very important point because we're just beginning to reflect this in our modern toxicology. We're not all equal. And you know that if you look at Cialis. Now, this is the part in the presentation where men of a certain age, I consider myself of that age, begin to take an extraordinary interest in the tops of their shoes. But stay with me, gentlemen. Cialis is active, as I said, at 30 parts per billion, but it has side effects, even if a playful moment becomes the right moment. And I say this knowing that all adults in the room, that you wouldn't have to be an adult. Any 10-year-old child who stays up past 9 o'clock at night sees this on television. One side effect is a headache, upset stomach, a delayed backache, which I presume is a backache that is late, or muscle ache at 30 parts per billion. If you have any sudden decrease in hearing or vision at 30 parts per billion, stop taking Cialis and seek immediate medical help at 30 parts per billion. And then, of course, there's the most famous side effect. I'll just let you read that. I just would ask the question, if you're also unable to hear or see, how do you make this call? Of the top 200 drugs on the market now by sales volume, 13% list serious side effects at less than 100 parts per billion. Low doses really matter to some people. Ambien, sleeping, at 59 parts per billion can cause hallucinations. Ativan, anti-anxiety drug, 20 parts per billion, can cause withdrawal symptoms in newborns born to the mothers who are taking the Ativan. OxyContin, we all know about the incredible problems we've had in this society with this painkiller. Addiction can happen at 10.6 parts per billion for some people. Methylene, this is used to treat attention deficit disorder. 10 parts per billion can cause Tourette syndrome in some people. Propecia, this is a hair loss drug mainly used for men. 9.2 parts per billion can produce testicular pain. Pretty low dose, pretty profound effects. Clarinex, allergies, that's the treatment, but at 4 parts per billion it can cause heart palpitations. And Paxil, as I mentioned, 2 parts per billion can, in some people, trigger suicidal behavior. Low doses really matter, but we know about them in the world of drugs. We don't know about these low-dose impacts or what might be happening with industrial chemicals because we don't test to find out what those effects might be. NuvaRing's another example. Now, these low doses also produce big impacts in our bodies in nature. And let me just give you a couple of extraordinary examples with hormones. Low doses, big deal. Prolactin promotes breast milk production. 2.8 to 29 parts per billion is active and promotes that function. Estradiol, far less than 1 part per billion. This controls female reproduction, system growth, and function. calcitonin, look at the level there. I can't even pronounce that level, I don't think. If this is maintains calcium levels in the body, if those, the timing of the dose, the nature of the person, all of these things matter a great deal, and we're just beginning to figure that out. So we have multiple toxins, low dose impacts, some people more vulnerable than others. That's the world in which we live with all these chemicals we're exposed to, even in the womb. But here's the thing. If they experience chemical side effects, they can't call their doctor. And that's where you come in. Because we're seeing major changes in disease and health that we cannot explain through genetics alone. We're not mutating that quickly. For example, hypophosphatasia. This is a birth defect that affects one out of 125 baby boys now. The defect is that the tip of the urethra does not come out at the tip of the penis. It comes out somewhere else along the shaft, and it requires surgery, usually when the baby is very young, to correct. One out of 125 baby boys, it doubled between 68 and 93. Cryptorchidism, another thing that affects baby boys, undescended testicles. 3% of full-term baby boys have this now. It's been increasing. We worry about this for its own right, but also because it's a major warning sign for the development of testicular cancer later in life. A 62% increase in acute lymphocytic leukemia in children between 1973 and 1999. What is going on? A 40% increase in childhood brain cancer between the mid-1970s and the mid-1990s. And this is where I like to point out what my friend Phil Landrigan, the pediatrician from Mount Sinai, says. That when sometimes people suggest that better diagnosis is behind some of these elevated rates over time, it's certainly a very important question to ask. But pediatricians were not missing brain cancer in the early 1970s. And they weren't missing it in the 60s, and they weren't missing it in the 50s. If a child has brain cancer, you know it. This is happening, this number is going up, because the incidence of this disease is going up. Autism, very controversial. We now know one in 150 boys, one in 150 children, 60% of them boys, are affected with autism somewhere on that spectrum. One out of every 15 children between the age of 5 and 17, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The profound impact these diseases, these problems, these health issues have on our school system, quite apart from the emotional distress on the parents and the families, these are the issues that amount to billions and billions and billions of dollars for us as a society to deal with. If there's any chance that some of these exposures interacting with genetic makeup and the special vulnerabilities of these little boys is causing this problem or any of these children, that's something we ought to be concerned about. Here's another set of data that just came out a week ago. Breast development, age of development by race, and you can see for white girls, the average age has been dropping steadily over time, and look what the figures are for African American girls, dropping even deeper, even faster, the onset of breast development. Hormonally regulated, something is going on that's causing this advancement to happen prematurely. We see a 3-5% incidence of birth defects in our population now. And over 7 million American couples have trouble becoming pregnant or carrying to full term. This is a 20% increase in the last 10 years. This is something that's been important in my family and the development of my own family. And I know we all know people who've had these difficulties. What you'd really be worried about would be if it was affecting women of childbearing age a lot or more. And it is. That's the group for whom this problem with fertility is rising the fastest. We also know that for men in North America and in Europe, there's been an average decrease in sperm count of about 1% per year, again, related to infertility, clearly. We know that 1 in 7 women will develop breast cancer during her lifetime in this country. 1 in 3 women and 1 in 2 men will develop cancer of some type in their lifetime. And we know that the United States has one of the highest rates of cancer incidence in the world. 17.7% compared to much lower levels in these countries I picked, Brazil, Japan, the UK, and Sweden. We also know that when people migrate from a country with lower rates of these cancers to the United States, like, for example, Japan, within two generations, the cancer rates jump up. Fourfold increase in prostate cancer, threefold increase in breast cancer for those who migrate from Japan to the United States within two generations. Scientists are beginning to focus on the contribution of chemicals to these diseases. We have a long way to go. Here's a recent study in the journal Cancer describing what's known about environmental pollutants in breast cancer. Here's an excerpt from a study in The Lancet speaking of the impacts this might be having on our school system, our ability of our children to learn. This is, again, Phil Landrigan and a colleague of his who say the combined evidence suggests that neurodevelopmental disorders caused by industrial chemicals have created a silent pandemic in modern society. We're paying the price, and we're only now just understanding what the root causes might be. So what can you do? Well, there are an awful lot of things people can do around the home, and I'll go through these very quickly in their personal life. You're legislators, and so obviously when people ask you these questions, you want to be able to say part of this is personal responsibility, where we want to take what steps we can to protect our families and ourselves. And you can do all kinds of these things and find out about them on our website and at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy and many other groups around the country. We can always prevent exposures, and it's especially important to do it in babies, providing them with the most safety we possibly can by being careful about what we feed them, what they're exposed to in the home, what types of products they're exposed to, and so forth. Of course, there are some exposures that cannot be prevented. Try as we might. And we don't live in a risk-free world. We do not live in a risk-free world. So we want to be responsible and thoughtful about how we take on these exposures if we need to. And I think the case is pretty clear. We can't just shop our way out of this. We need society to act. We need government to act at the state level and at the national level. And for the first time in a generation, we are seeing policy reform on the horizon. And I happen to think this is going to be one of the most important environmental developments in history. We're all concerned about climate change, and rightfully so, but the impacts of toxic chemicals and our exposure to them on human health is becoming a profound concern and generating much more activity. And it's unfolding, this effort, at the states and at the national level. And here's the problem. The Toxic Substances Control Act that controls most of the industrial chemicals I've been talking about was signed into law in 1976 by this gentleman, may he rest in peace, Gerry Ford, and it has not been reauthorized and modernized since. Think of all the advances in our understanding of health, chemicals, toxics, and we're stuck with a major environmental law, the only major environmental law that's never been reauthorized, the Toxic Substances Control Act. It does not require health and safety studies for new chemicals. If a company comes to EPA and they want to put a new chemical on the market, there's no list of health studies that must be conducted at the agency, no list of health studies listed in the law, nothing whatsoever. 62,000 chemicals were grandfathered in at the time this law was passed. They were presumed safe, with the idea being that EPA would go back and examine to see if they in fact were. Clearly, this is a system that's broken and badly out of date. EPA has reviewed in the 30 years since passage just 200 of these 62,000 old chemicals. It's a little bit more than that now, about 204, which is pretty slow progress. 80% of the chemicals that come into EPA, 80% are approved in 3 weeks. Not much of a review period. And only 5 chemicals have been banned or restricted by EPA under this law. And my dear friend Sue Vento is here in the audience. We have been working to try and pass a law to ban asbestos because the Toxic Substances Control Act is so weak that when EPA tried to ban asbestos, they were defeated in court. That's how weak this law is, and we know very clearly the impact of asbestos on human health. So this is the problem. Now, let me tell you the other problem. This is a nonstick pan. Until a few years ago, no one really gave much thought to the ingredients in its making or whether they might be causing any contamination problems, but we've come to find out that that is in fact the case. There were some early signs, such as over the years people reporting that an overheated Teflon pan kills pet birds instantly, which should have been something of a tip-off, the fumes that come off the pan. There are other things that can kill birds in a kitchen, but a Teflon pan left on the stove within a few minutes reaching a high temperature, the fumes that come off of that will kill a bird. And I've had people call me to tell me their bird was dead, what had happened, and I asked them, what were you doing? Just doing nothing. I was getting ready to cook breakfast. A few years ago, when 3M and DuPont were looking into perfluorinated chemicals, and they wanted to find out, 3M in particular, wanted to find out maybe if there was a difference between the amount of the chemical in the blood of their workers and the uncontaminated blood in the population, they collected blood from blood banks around the country. And what they came to find out when they tried to compare the clean blood with the workers' blood was there was no clean blood. It was all contaminated. They went to all over this country, Europe, other parts of the world. The only blood that was reliably uncontaminated was blood that was collected from Korean War veterans and archived for study later. They also came to find out that in a study that DuPont did in 1982, they found that the Teflon chemical, PFOA, formerly manufactured by 3M here and then manufactured by DuPont when 3M dropped its manufacture a few years ago, they found it in the umbilical cord blood of 7 babies they tested of women born who had worked in the Parkersburg Teflon plant on the line. They tested the baby's blood and found the chemical. And even more disturbing, they found birth defects in 2 of the 7 babies that were tested, exactly the birth defects that were predicted by a few animal studies, defects of the nostril and the tear duct. I've actually met one of these 2 babies who's grown up and has had many years of painful surgeries as a consequence of this exposure. And this led to some pretty serious consequences for DuPont, like a record fine. We've also found that these chemicals are now in polar bears. They're in marine mammals all over the world. They're in birds that live on remote islands in the middle Pacific. These perfluorinated chemicals contaminate the biosphere. They last in our blood 3 or 4 years, likewise with other mammals, and they have not been shown yet to break down in the environment at all. At all. Unlike PCBs or dioxins, they seem to be staying with us forever. Well, that's what I would consider a pretty big flaw in a law if you can't catch chemicals like that in your safety review. And we didn't. And we still won't under the law we now have. DuPont, among others, has had some serious consequences, including a record fine. But they've also announced that they're moving to adjust their company's production of Teflon so that we'll still have Teflon, but without this PFOA stuff. Industries can make changes. We need a modern safety net for toxic chemicals. And at the federal level, there's lots of state action at the federal level. One that's been proposed and will be reintroduced this year is the Kids Safe Chemical Act. It requires that chemicals be safe for children and others who are sensitive. It modernizes the toxicology. It mandates precaution and action in the face of uncertainty. When you're in doubt, don't let the chemical on the market without a complete data set, without adequate testing. It assumes that chemicals may be harming people until proven otherwise. It reverses the burden of proof. Right now, EPA had to try and prove that there were problems with these various chemicals, like the Teflon chemical, like the 3M chemical, the Scotchgard chemical. EPA had to prove there was harm. This reverses the burden of proof so that the companies would have to prove safety. A much easier, much more, from my standpoint, sensible thing for companies who want access. And it uses biomonitoring, the science of studying the pollution in people. It uses that as the threshold, the trigger for determining which chemicals we'll study first, the chemicals that are ending up in us. If that's the case, we're going to expect that they be given a rigorous safety review. Now, there's an unprecedented coalition across the country worrying now about toxic chemicals and public health. Scientists and scientific organizations, top authorities in medical, in medicine and health, and health-affected groups, particularly those worried about learning disabilities, among other problems, cancer. A broad spectrum of religious leaders have come to visualize the problem of exposures in the womb as a violation of the sanctity of human life. And this discussion has become richer and richer over time as people have thought about the fact that we want babies born into this world toxic-free if at all possible. And finally, of course, a wide array of environmental and public interest groups. And of course, we hope you. Now, we can make these big changes, and I just want to end with this, because we've done it before, and we forget sometimes the lessons we've learned and what we've accomplished. Let's go back to air pollution. I mentioned earlier the slide at the beginning of the talk. It's a big problem in this country still. We're all worried about it. In 1988, we passed a law that didn't regulate the polluting facilities. It just required them to report on their pollution, the toxics release inventory. In 1988, 2 billion pounds of air pollution reported in that inventory. Just by requiring reporting, not regulation, we've knocked that down to about 50.57 billion pounds, 570 million pounds in 2004. Not enough. We still need to do more, but a significant change. And we still have tremendously productive industry. Water pollution, similar story. 42 million pounds in 88. We require reporting, not regulation. Down to 22 million pounds. Not okay, but a huge reduction, almost half. Let's look at what we've done with lead. This is the chart that shows lead coming out of gasoline. Big fight at the time. It was said that we couldn't deal with fuel economy, get good mileage, have engines perform correctly if we took the lead out of gasoline. But we did take it out. And look what happened to blood lead levels. They plummeted across the population. We still have problems with children living in older homes being lead poisoned. It's a big deal. But we can make these big changes society-wise if society-wide if we act. DDT in humans, similar kind of story. It comes onto the market in the late 1930s. One study shows 8,000 parts per billion. In 1972, around the time it was about to be banned, it does get banned, and the blood levels go right down. Now, we found DDT breakdown products in the babies that we tested, and those babies were tested in 2004 and 2005. The samples were taken then. We still found it 30 years later. So it's not a good idea to wait too long if you've got a toxic persistent chemical. It's going to stick around and still be found. But we have, look at this progress. And likewise, PCBs. At the time PCBs drew attention in the 1970s, it was the principal insulating chemical we used in electrical equipment all around the country. And it was said at the time, it was speculated maybe our electricity, our modern grid, couldn't even function without PCBs. But nonetheless, the Monsanto product came on the market in the 30s. 15 parts per billion in one study back in the early 1970s. It's banned. The only thing that the Toxic Substances Control Act really did was ban PCBs in 76. And look at the levels in the American people's blood. Dropped down. We can make this happen. I want to thank you for your attention to this issue. There's an awful lot to be considered and discussed. But this is our focus. This is the population we're most worried about. They can't call their doctor. They can't conduct the research. They can't challenge companies yet to do the right thing. But they couldn't be more vulnerable, and they couldn't be more precious to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. I appreciate your presentation here today. And I'd like to open it up for any questions that members may have for Mr. Cook at this point. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cook, have any states gone beyond this? I think, what about California's notification law, and what's happening in any European countries on this issue? Is there any model for that?
There are activities in dozens of states now around the country. California has initiated its own biomonitoring bill. They're going to do their own biomonitoring of toxic chemicals. In Europe, they have initiated a program that will require much additional chemical reporting, make mandatory some of the voluntary programs we have here in this country. not as ambitious as the KidSafe Chemical Act that's being discussed. At the state level, there are actions being taken to deal with specific categories of chemicals, either chemicals like the flame retardants that have been shown to show up in people, including in the babies we tested. Also, people are looking at certain categories of products to which children might be particularly exposed, whether it's toys or baby bottles or other types of things. Dr. Walenga is going to be talking about some of the things that are happening here in Minnesota. So there's a tremendous amount of activity on this now, but again, a lot of it goes back to the basic question that we haven't really studied the pollution in people until recently. And now that we're doing it, people are asking some very profound questions.
And Mr. Cook, I was going to ask about the disparity in the level of cancer in different parts of the world, why it's so much higher here in the U.S. I mean, you were pointing out some countries that are industrialized, like Japan, for instance. They're producing a lot of these chemicals as well. Is it that they're not producing as much or not consuming as much, or what's the reason?
You know, the truth of the matter is we don't know for any given disease what exactly might be the difference in the two causes. Some people have speculated it might be diet-related, and that might be just an impact of obesity. It also might mean that the chemicals in our food supply, eaten arguably at excessive levels, might also be triggering some of these illnesses.
Representative Beinhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cook, I want to ask you a little bit of a speculative, philosophical question, but generally when we get into this whole area of regulation, the counter-argument is that we're suppressing business and industry, that, you know, it's not good for the economy, etc. So how do we support a model that gets into the chemical research cycle early enough to be perceived more constructively by business and industry, and not repressing research that's already been done or products that are new to the market, but to help in a much earlier stage of research development? Does the question make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and it's exactly the question that often comes up. I would answer it in two ways. One, I do think we need modernized rules of the road, if you were, for industrial chemicals. We do need to require additional safety testing and more rigorous health standards for the chemicals that are coming into the market or in some cases have been on the market. That's a way of avoiding the kinds of disruptions we found in the case of 3M having to change its formulation of the Scotchgard chemical. I think they took it. It was initially reported several $100 million charge against earnings just for making the transition out of that chemical. Well, that's a big economic impact. Likewise, DuPont. They've had to make some significant changes, but they've begun to make them. DuPont is predicting now that they'll be out of the business of making and using PFOA, this chemical that's in all of us, that's caused such a stir, by 2015. They've turned their inventiveness into an asset, just like DuPont did with CFCs decades ago. When we were worried about the ozone layer thinning, DuPont was the company that was contributing much of the chemical. They were the first company to come up with non-CFC solutions. So there's money to be made here. And that goes to the second point. The countries that are going to be on the edge of a green chemistry, and which we can support through research, development, I think the government has a role to play there, they're going to be able, if we do it right, to outcompete those who are working just from the lowest common denominator of price. I'm not sure we can compete as an American chemical industry if it's not competing on the basis of inventiveness and safety and health, because we are not going to be able to compete on the basis of cost with China and India and these other countries. We want to raise the bar and make them meet it and reward the companies who do research and development to get us there. And there are plenty of them. The American chemical industry is enormously resourceful, and they can get there. But it is a moment of decision-making where there will be some conflict. Some companies don't invest very much in research and development. They may not be too willing to take on tougher new safety standards.
Representative Dunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I used to teach a case study unit on the practice of the Control Act and how in the final stages of the deliberation on Act, the burden of proof was shifted in the end game. And some of the original texts had the burden of proof on the other side if they had to be proved safe. In terms of what is going on, Representative Reinhart's comment, because I think that we do have other regulatory environments in other parts of the world that already use the precautionary principle, and therefore we should have information about whether or not in those environments they have been successful about having early enough intervention so as to not dampen, you know, business innovation, those kinds of things. I don't know the answer to it, but we do know that that's already going on elsewhere, and therefore we could look at the data about what's happened in those scenarios versus what's been happening in our U.S. history with regards to that. We should be able to sort that out when contemplating alternative regulatory scenarios in this particular case. So I would think that that information is available to do that.
Just one more thing to add is, you know, I gave a couple of examples where it was said at the time that regulatory action would basically be the end of the world. I mean, it was said when we were talking about getting rid of DDT that we might not be able to feed ourselves. 60% of it was used on cotton in this country at the time, but we still seem to be doing okay. Maybe we even are eating too well. Likewise with PCBs, likewise with lead and gasoline, many of the air pollution issues we have. And look, I'm not saying that anyone who represents those industries shouldn't have their right to make their case, and we want to listen to both sides very carefully. We certainly can do that. But time after time, we find out that when it looks like it's the end of the world, industry actually can cope pretty quickly and pretty effectively if they're given reasonable rules of the road. And that's what we want here, I think.
Representative Bunn, follow
up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could you just give us an update on the current status of the kids? Did they ever get a hearing?
It's going to be reintroduced, I would say, within a month or two in both the House and the Senate. Mm-hmm. And we don't know beyond that what a hearing schedule might be, but I expect it will receive a pretty rigorous discussion and debate in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cook, last year in the education finance bill, we spent almost half of our money on paying back some cuts from special education from 5 years ago. We have another $80 million to go just to be up to the cuts, not counting inflation since then, which is going up 5% a year. Do you have, with this new information, do you know of any models being set up to make any correlations? You mentioned the increased incidence of some of these problems that might show up in children, but is there any research being done to directly connect certain chemicals with certain outcomes so that we could...
There is a great deal of research underway. Some of the chemicals that have been most studied, like lead, for example, we know that has an impact on the child's ability to cognitive learning, all kinds of neurological functions. And we know that that has imposed a tremendous cost on our educational system in dealing with children that have been affected. What's happening now is, and this is common across a lot of different chemicals, Dr. Willingham may speak to this, the more we study a chemical, the lower the level at which we're comfortable that it's safe. So in the case of 10 for lead, that level is now being challenged by a number of researchers who are saying damage is probably happening, neurological damage is probably happening below the level that we're testing children for and saying it's safe. So I think mercury is another one where we're very much worried about the impacts on the developing child, ability to cognitive function, neurological development, motor functions too. So there's a range of those, and some people have even begun to put some price tags on those kinds of impacts. Education and healthcare, of course, are the big ones.
And Representative Wardenius.
Thank you. You talked a bit about green chemistry, and we're certainly talking about a new economy with green jobs in Minnesota. And I understand some universities have actually made green chemistry a formal thing in their chemistry department. Do you know how that's come about? And if there is a model that we can suggest to our own university?
Well, I would look at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, for example. It's a place where they have invested heavily in sustainable chemistry, green chemistry. And, you know, I just think some of my background is in chemistry from graduate school. And I have to say, talk about inventive. Talk about being able to solve problems. They just need a different set of problems to be put before them. No one is going to come up faster with greener solutions than the American chemical industry if they put their minds to it. But it's a competitive industry. They're faced with pretty high price increases for energy these days, a lot of pressure on them and their profits and their employment. So I think there are models out there for anyone to consider, and we'll certainly provide information to the committee of those kinds of investments. But, you know, the big investments are made by the companies themselves. That's where billions are spent over the years in research and development. And for that, I think it's helpful to have a set of standards put in place that they should aim towards, even as the public side comes in and makes investments in university programs to train people for this new economy. Very exciting.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Heard you on the radio this morning, too, by the way. Appreciate that. I had looked up on your website in previous months to see how many of my constituents in North Oaks are getting farm subsidies.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. Quite a few, although I will say it was mostly for conservation reserve, so it's a little better anyway. And I've heard your presentation before, and it's made me think of a couple things, but I'm a little distressed because it feels like we're playing whack-a-mole, too. I mean, you go after PCBs, and then you get decabromodiphenylether, and we've considered a legislation last year to phase that out, and it's, I don't know, we might do it, but it's taken so long just to focus on one thing, and yet there are tens of thousands of other things, and anytime you're dealing with certain kind of chemical bonds, you know, for a product that is needed for a certain purpose, we just can't get away from something that persists. I don't know if you can alleviate my worries about where we're going in the future, but are we just getting a little less toxic each time we phase out one other thing, or?
Well, you know, it's a problem because we don't have an underlying health standard against which to judge the new chemicals that come on. Let's say you replace something that you know is toxic, lasts a long time in the environment, is persistent. Right now, unlike, for example, for pesticides, we don't have a system in place whereby the chemical that's replacing it will have to meet the same standards. So that's really what we need to have is a health-based standard against which to judge what exposures should be allowed, what uses should be allowed, which ones should be phased out. Right now, we do tend to go one chemical at a time, and it's a problem. For the reason you mentioned, it's also a problem for the companies. They never know from one moment to the next which chemical is going to pop up as being the one that's in the regulatory jeopardy. And as a consequence, we're sort of moving from one drama to the next, and we don't know if we're taking care of the most important exposures and the most important chemicals. We need a new comprehensive approach to be able to do that. I think that steps can be taken at the state level to go in that direction, certainly with research and more rational regulatory organization looking at chemicals, for example, by starting on what's in people and how can we reduce those exposures. But at some point, it's obviously got to be a federal responsibility, too. We can't have different safety standards forever for all these different chemicals in 50 different states.
Thanks, and I think that's an excellent point as far as dealing with this piecemeal, the inefficiency and ineffectiveness of doing it in that way and needing a more comprehensive plan or policy in place. I wanted to bring up an issue that I think is related here as far as policy making is concerned. You mentioned the Toxic Substances Control Act, which was passed in 76 and that was not reauthorized, and nothing really has been done since then in that arena. It seems to me that the issue of campaign finance also comes into play here as far as whether things are moving forward or not. And I don't know if any studies have been done or if you want to address this issue or not, but the issue of the amount of money that is being put into campaigns from the chemical industry and whether that's inhibiting the ability to move forward on a more comprehensive policy.
Well, there seem to be a number of things that are inhibiting forward progress, but I do think there's, again, a big change just in the last 4 or 5 years. I don't have the figures at the tips of my fingers to tell you. I know it's a large industry. They're very well represented in Washington. They're very happy with the Toxic Substances Control Act. They don't want to change it. It's working very well for them. And they participate actively in every debate I've been involved in involving these issues. So I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. But I do think that there are, within the industry, more and more people thinking that the United States ought to be competing on the world stage on the basis of the greenest possible, safest possible products, and that we can beat anybody at doing that if we choose to do it.
Mm-hmm.
On cost, not so clear that we can win that race to the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. And Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cook, I don't know where Jesse Johnson was from, but I'm just kind of curious if you...
New York.
He what?
New York.
New York. I'm just kind of curious about the 1 in 115 for autism and the 1 in 15 for ADHD, and I'm wondering if you're seeing any differences in those numbers between metro and a pure rural that doesn't have, say, a coal-fired power plant or a factory. Do you see any difference in there that would... that you can identify?
You know, I wish I could say I had those numbers at my fingertips too, but may I get back to you about that? I'm not, I know that the 1 in 150 is the number that came out of the Centers for Disease Control for autism, with 60% being boys. That came out just last year. I'm not sure, they may even have updated it, but the number's been going up. And everyone's obviously very concerned about it, but I don't know about regional differences or urban versus rural, but I'll try and find out for you. Get back to the committee.
I think, Representative Scalzi, that would be very helpful information, considering the fact that I know you're mentioning some of the things where you can't blame it on saying that we didn't catch it in the past, like brain cancer, for instance. I mean, that's something that you couldn't overlook in the past, but autism is something that's a little bit more difficult to get a handle on, how much there was in the past and whether it was just not being reported or caught. I think it would be helpful if we could see if there's any kind of regional differences, if there's a connection there.
Along the full spectrum of autism, some being expressed in more milder ways than others, that's where the debate is. But I don't think there's much debate about severely autistic individuals, because if we had the same level of incidence for that, again, 30 or 40 years ago, you ask yourself the question, where are all the adult severely autistic people? Well, they're not there because we didn't have the same problem back then. And you know, the question really has become now breaking down the old dichotomy that no longer seems to work, nature versus nurture. Now the new science is saying it's the interaction of the two. It's the way our genes are turned on by exposures to specific chemicals, and the genetic makeup of some individuals being different than others, conveying that susceptibility. That's really where the science is evolving now. And the more we learn about it, the more we learn that some people truly are more vulnerable. Maybe they come into the world that way, and if they're exposed, maybe it's the autistic children, the boys in particular, some metabolic pathway that's being triggered by an environmental event. Well, that's the kind of thing that I think we want to see if we can avoid at all. We certainly want to. You up and running, Doc?
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question in terms of, I know Europe has gotten much stronger chemical policy than the United States, and just if you could comment on how that is affected our chemical industries and European chemical industries, and then if there's any studies on how, if there's any studies on health effects, or if there's been any improvements because of it, that study showing improvements in Europe.
It's too early. The program was really only enacted last year fully by the European Union, the Parliament in Brussels. They're just really now putting that program together. They're going to create a new agency, Europe-wide agency, for the implementation of this new program. So they're just now beginning to try and understand what kinds of information is going to be forthcoming from the companies, how they can use that, if at all, for regulatory purposes, what next steps will be taken. And in the European Union, there's considerable ability for the member nations to themselves expressed their views about the pace of regulation against the specific chemical. So that complicates matters there pretty significantly. So I don't have, there isn't much information on that yet. The chemical industry in Europe fought that proposal very hard. Environmental advocates and some scientific experts and medical professionals fought on the other side. They made some compromises, and now we'll have to wait and see a few years how it begins to play out.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cook, you did a pretty good job of showing that the dose makes the poison.
Showing you what?
That the dose makes the poison. And that have you looked at the data, or maybe Dr. Loinga can answer this in his presentation, but the difference between an acute exposure or a chronic exposure over a period of time. I think there's or data that shows that maybe there's been an acute exposure and it represents itself maybe two or three generations later. Any data on that or any?
It depends dramatically across substances and across diseases or health effects. A good example, a very brief exposure for some people to asbestos fibers will trigger mesothelioma maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years later. Some children who are exposed very briefly to lead or other toxins immediately have an impact on brain function, whereas other children in the range of effects, it's lower. So sometimes an acute effect can be seen immediately, and you can deal with it as a health problem if possible, or at least recognize it as such. Sometimes an acute exposure does not produce the effect for a generation, and yet you have the terrible impact decades later. So it varies enormously across chemical and across health effects. And the point about dose making the poison is that, you know, sometimes it can be a very low dose, and we shouldn't discount that. We should make sure that anyone who says low doses don't matter, make sure they've studied the dose before they can assure you it doesn't matter.
Thank you. Well, seeing no other questions, Mr. Cook, again, thank you very much. And next, we do have Mr. Willinga, Dr. Willinga, who is going to be presenting today. I have not had the privilege of seeing you present. I look forward to hearing your testimony today. So if you could state your name for the record, please, and continue. And by the way, Dr. Willinga said that he's open to questions during the presentation as well, if anybody has any questions along the way. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Wallinga. I'm the director of the Food and Health Program at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and as well as working with Healthy Legacy.
Thank you.
So Ken Cook's always a hard act to follow, as I'm sure you can appreciate, but I'm going to give it a good shot. And I'm actually, my comments are going to mesh nicely, I think. I'll be able to elaborate a little bit on some of the themes that he brought up and dig a little bit more into some of the science, a lot of which is very recent. And I think what I'll do is try to get through the first part and then have a pause and take some questions, and then if I could, then resume the talk, if that'll work fine.
Sure.
So the talk is really in three different parts, and perhaps before I start, I should just say that a lot of what I'm going to talk about, you know, I went to medical school here in Minnesota, and I wish I could say that a lot of what we're talking about is taught in the medical school, but the fact of the matter is that the science is really quite new, and it also doesn't fit very well within the educational paradigms of what's taught in medicine or toxicology or chemistry. And so that's one of the challenges of looking at this kind of an issue, it is that it's new and it's sort of outside the normal silos that people learn these issues. Ken talked about some of these statistics, and I don't want to get too bogged down in the rate, but I want to just point out that however one dices it, the prevalence of learning and developmental disabilities across the population is quite high. about 17% of children have at least one and sometimes multiple learning behavioral or developmental disabilities. And the question was asked whether the rates are going up, and this is part of the challenge, is that we don't have national surveillance of children's chronic disorders and diseases other than cancer. And so we frequently get in this very long and protracted discussion about whether things are going up or not, and it, to some degree that's besides the question. To another degree, it's really a hard and almost impossible question to answer, and in any case, the prevalence of these things is very large. They may be increasing. In some cases, they almost certainly are increasing. What we do know is that the costs are increasing, and I'm talking not just about the treatment costs, but the emotional cost to the children, to the families, the cost to the families taking time off work or kids taking time off school, the service costs. And for any of you that have a child with one of these disabilities, the service costs can be enormous, and of course they're enormous to the state as well. And the most recent data from the Minnesota Department of Education is that the annual bill for special ed expenditures is on the order of $1.4 billion. As Ken Cook said, one of the recent understandings that's come out of the science is that old nature versus nurture paradigm is just way too simplistic and wrong, actually. Not only for learning and developmental disabilities, but for most chronic diseases. Because in fact, what's happening with our chronic health, our long-term health, is a very complex interaction of things. Genes, yeah, they're important. We can't change those very easily. But also nutrition, the social environment, the chemical environment, and maybe most importantly, how all these things interact. And this is not only critically important, but it's incredibly difficult to study using the tools that we have. And so what happens is that there's a lot of pressure to have sort of a smoking gun, a cause and effect relationship between a certain exposure and a certain outcome, like a learning disability. And for an individual, that's pretty much impossible to ascertain. And even at a population level, it's really hard to find that smoking gun because there's multiple factors that are occurring simultaneously. Now the flip side of that, the positive side, is that if you can identify something like a chemical exposure that is a contributor, and you can prevent that exposure, you may be preventing some of the disability or the disease. And, you know, as policymakers and people looking over the future investment of the state, that's a very important conclusion. So I'm going to spend a few minutes just talking about normal brain development. The first thing to know about brain development is that it's incredibly complex. It's like this intricate ballet that has a very ordered sequence. And what you'll see here on the left-hand side are different kinds of processes. There has to be a multiplication of cells. The cells have to migrate to different parts of the brain. They have to form connections between the cells. There have to be, those are synapses. And then the neurons have to myelinate. They have to get this fatty sheath around the neurons that's going to allow signals to be transmitted fast between cells. And this happens at different rates in different parts of the brain at different times, and it occurs over a span of more than 20 years into adulthood. Okay? So it's a very complex process. It requires good nutrition for the brain to optimally develop. Okay? We need good brain food. And one of the things I want to highlight is that the brain's about 60% fat. So healthful fatty acids are essential to form the membranes, the cell membranes of that brain tissue. And so we need good food, good fats. This is a problem because the American diet is grossly deficient in the most helpful kinds of fats. Omega-3 fatty acids, for example. I'm going to go into that a little bit at the end. So, because of this ordered sequence of development in the young brain, it's really vulnerable to disruption. And I'm talking about disruption either from poor nutrition or from environmental chemicals. And because it has to be ordered, if one of those early sequences is disrupted, it's going to have downstream effects. We don't necessarily know what the downstream effects is going to be because it's going to depend on the timing of when that insult, when that chemical exposure took place. Okay? Because of that complex ballet, if the exposure is at one point in fetal development, it might have a completely different effect than if the exposure took place a month later. Okay? The young brain is qualitatively different than the mature brain because it's going through this development. It's also more vulnerable because it's immature, and some of the things that we count on as adults to protect their brain tissue are not fully developed. Some of the detoxifying enzyme systems, the blood-brain barrier, DNA repair, these things are not always fully developed. Another thing to note about this process is that it takes place under the guidance of hormones that signal when these different parts of the ballet have to happen. So if you have a hormone-disrupting chemical, that could be a bad thing. It could disrupt that signaling process and lead to sequencing problems in the brain. Of course, this doesn't just apply to the brain. It applies to all the developing organs in the baby. I'm just talking about one organ, an important one. What you see in this picture is a color-coded thing that indicates that this process of maturation of the brain takes place throughout childhood, into adolescence, and even adulthood. And that myelination takes place all the way through adolescence. You could see particular problems with demyelinating exposures. You know, solvents in particular eat through fatty tissue. And so kids who are sniffing glue or have similar sorts of solvent exposures in adolescence can have problems affecting that myelin. Now, I said the windows of vulnerability can be very discrete because of this delicate ballet. And here's just one example. A few years ago, research was done of people with autism and thalidomide exposure. And what they found is that there was a higher rate of autism among certain thalidomide-exposed adults. And they went back and they figured out when the thalidomide exposure actually took place. So this is a pharmaceutical that is associated with autism from an exposure in utero. And they were able to nail it down that the critical exposure happened in just a 4-day window, 3 weeks into gestation. This is before a lot of people even know they're pregnant, right? So if the exposure happened before the 20th day of gestation or after the 24th day, no autism. But if it happened in that critical window, you saw autism. And so this is a bit of a model for how discrete these windows can actually be. And they were able to confirm this in animal studies where they were actually able to dose the animals in the laboratory at the corresponding time in their gestation and see changes in brain chemistry, like serotonin levels or dopamine levels, for example. Now, in the mid-1990s, the National Institutes of Health and EPA joined up to invest in children's environmental health research centers, and some of the currently funded ones are listed here on the slide. There aren't many in the middle of the country. There is one research center in Illinois. There's none in the upper Midwest. But what's happened from this small-ish investment, I think at the most it was $12 million a year, has been an incredible explosion of research that has changed the science around how environmental chemicals are affecting children. And so you see journals like Environmental Health Perspectives, I'm going to talk about a lot, that continually publish articles. And if you look at this explosion of science as a whole, what you're seeing is abundant and ever-increasing science that actually ties the link between these early life exposures to chemicals and learning and developmental disabilities. So that's what I'm going to talk about now. You already know some of this. All of us do, because we're told not to drink alcohol while pregnant, right? And we all know about lead exposure. And what we know from our experience with lead is that the widespread use of lead since 1925 literally has harmed millions of children. And Bruce Lamphere is a pediatrician and a researcher in Cincinnati. He gets one of those grants from NIH. And he estimates that almost 13 million children, because of their lead exposure from 1972 to 1988, have been adversely affected. So we know there's been harm. One of the other things we know from lead is that what we think is a safe level of exposure actually decreases quite dramatically over time to these neurotoxins. And lead is kind of the case study. So, for example, when I was born, a safe level of lead was considered to be 60 micrograms per deciliter. Okay. Now there is no safe level of lead exposure. Okay. So what happened over that time? Did lead get more toxic? No, of course not. The scientists got better at measuring it, at measuring sensitive effects. They looked at more sensitive populations. They looked earlier in life. They funded bigger studies with more statistical power. All of these things lowered what we found to be a safe level of exposure and eventually eliminated it. Now, throughout most of the last 30 years, the effect that's gotten the most attention is that lead actually decreases IQ points. And it's a dose-response relationship. And you can measure how much a given amount of lead exposure will decrease IQ. What most people don't know is that, and this again is research in the New England Journal of Medicine by Bruce Lamphere and others, is that the first increase in blood lead up to a unit of 10 micrograms per deciliter has the greatest impact on IQ. Now, above that, it gets worse, but actually the bigger bang for the buck in terms of IQ loss is that first 10 units. Now, that's important because the CDC's action level starts at 10. So that means there's children being affected below what the CDC and the WHO say is the action level for lead exposure. So no safe level. Now, one might argue that these are small amounts of IQ points. And in fact, if you looked at the average blood lead between when I was born and, say, the year 2000, the IQ loss on average was probably between 2 and 5 points. And these are fairly small shifts for an individual. But what happens in a population? Well, let's take the IQ distribution. It's called a normal distribution. It's even. And the mean is at 95. We know that. And the tail end are the really smart people and the not so smart people. And so you would expect there to be even amounts of gifted people and those falling under the definition of mentally retarded, okay, which is under 70. Well, if you shift that normal curve by just 5 IQ points, if you shift it from 100 down to 95, what happens across the population? Because the whole population was exposed to lead. Well, what you do is you shrink the number of gifted by more than half, and you increase the number who meet the definition of mentally retarded by the same amount, by about 60%. So this has enormous implications at a societal level. In 2006, The research department from the Minnesota House was asked to estimate the cost to Minnesota for one cohort of kids, five-year-olds, looking at their lifetime earnings, which will be decreased because of the lower IQ points due to lead exposure. And the estimates looked at two different ways of calculating the IQ loss. But whether you look at Model 1 or Model 2, the estimate was that for just this one cohort of kids, a cost to Minnesota on the order of $600 million to $1.1 billion a year. Now, of course, the next year's cohort of five-year-olds is going to have a similar loss in the next year and the next year and next year. So I say this not to focus too much on lead, but to say, let's think about the cumulative impact of all the different brain toxins or neurotoxins that these young fetuses and children are exposed to. What's the cumulative impact on the state and the earning potential of the state citizens from all those? Well, the positive side of this is that if you can intervene, like we did to take lead out of gasoline, the potential benefits to society are enormous. And in fact, Scott Gross, who's a health economist with the Centers for Disease Control, estimated that the benefit to the country of a cohort of two-year-olds growing up with lower blood lead because of lead being taken out of gasoline was on the order of $100 to $300 billion a year. So some of that's going to accrue to Minnesota as well as everyone else. Well, one of the other lessons of lead is that the impacts aren't just IQ, right? Because, again, it's a complex ballet of brain development. All sorts of different things depend on a functioning brain, an optimally functioned brain. IQ is just one measure. Well, it turns out, after having done 40 years of research on lead, that all these different traits, okay, all these different traits are affected, from impulsivity to aggression to hyperactivity to social skills, reading and math, memory, word recognition, visual skills, motor skills, etc. And if you many of these occur under sort of the standard definitions of learning disabilities for either ADHD or learning disabilities or other developmental disabilities. Some like aggression don't fit so easily. Now, if that was your child, those would seem like pretty big traits. You would notice if your child was impulsive or had difficulty concentrating, but they're really hard to measure. And so to actually find evidence in the research of these quote-unquote subtle effects has taken decades, over which time children continue to be exposed to lead. So here's just one example. This is a lead poisoned 12-year-old who was asked to draw a complex figure of a spaceship that looks like, and compared to a normal child. And what you see is extremely disorganized drawing ability. Now, if you looked at that child, would you be able to tell they were lead poisoned? No. And yet, something as simple as the ability to draw can be very powerfully impacted. So, I already talked about that. What's interesting is that if you look at the other neurotoxins, neurotoxic chemicals about which we know quite a bit, you see the same pattern. With mercury, too, for example, between when we first realized that mercury was affecting children exposed in utero, from Minamata Bay in Japan in the 1950s and 60s up through today, there's been a decrease in what's considered a safe dose of on the order of 1,000-fold. Again, mercury's not getting more dangerous. We're getting better at measuring these things. Science is progressing. And the impact to Minnesota from the addition of this to the other neurotoxin lead is only increased as well. PCBs, we see the same picture again. The early studies were done in rodents, signified here with an R. it took time to get the money to put together the long-term epidemiologic studies in mammals, higher mammals like primates, and with an M, and then effect of impacts on memory in humans, which is the last study. But as we did those studies, what we found is a 74,000-fold reduction in what was considered to be a safe level of in utero exposure to PCBs. So again, it goes back to Ken Cook's point about sometimes little doses really do matter. Now, I outlined here in a lead all the different parts of brain development that we know lead impact, but other things impact those same parts of brain development: alcohol, mercury, PCBs, some pesticides, as well as radiation, nicotine exposure. So there's cumulative impacts occurring. We're just not really measuring them or don't know how to measure them. When we put all this science together with a group of other physicians in a report called In Harm's Way that came out in 2000, you saw the journal article over here that was based upon it. What we found is actually there's quite a rich literature of routine exposures to neurotoxins impacting on children. And impaired IQ, again, is just one of the impacts. Memory and learning are impacted, and other neurodevelopmental parameters. They're not the only things impacting kids. We also know that dietary deficiencies like iron deficiency can have some of the same effects. Low thyroid can have some of the same effects. But in the world of neurotoxic chemicals, these are just the ones that we happen to have studied. They're the ones under the lamppost. We have a lot of data, but a lot less certain data for pesticide exposures, and even less data still for solvents other than alcohol, for brominated flame retardants, for perchlorate, for bisphenol A, for phthalates. All of these have early warning data coming out from animal studies, but it would take probably decades to put together the rich kind of expensive long-term prospective studies in exposed babies that we have for lead and mercury and PCBs. So the question is, what do we do in the interim? Do we continue to expose and hope that those children are not going to be injured the way they were with the lead and exposures and the mercury? Or do we figure out a different way? I would point out that even though those are the few chemicals for which we have good human data in children showing that they've been harmed, the universe of chemicals thought to be neurotoxic is actually much bigger than that. So the Office of Technology Assessment used to be the research arm that informed the U.S. Congress until it was disbanded. They estimated 3-5% of all toxic chemicals may be neurotoxic, 2,400 to 4,000 chemicals. The EPA has said that of the 900 registered pesticides under FIPRA, 140 are known neurotoxins. These are organophosphates or carbamates or pyrethroids. They know those to be neurotoxic. Have they been tested for their effect on the developing brain, the more sensitive developing brain? No, they haven't. So we can't say with certainty that they're toxic to the developing brain, although we have a lot of strong suspicions on that score. What we do have, this is this study by Philippe Grandjean that came out last year that actually combed the data biases to find how many chemicals we actually have good, solid data in people showing that it's toxic to the human brain, and the number is 201. Of those, only the underlined ones have been formally tested for their effects on the developing brain in people. About six. I think many more have been tested in animal studies. So again, this is the situation we're at. We have an iceberg with 82,000 chemicals registered in the TSCA. If we believe the OTA, maybe 3 to 5% are neurotoxins. But because of the weakness of TSCA, they've not been tested for their impact on the young brain, the fetal brain. Okay. So let me just have a few more slides and then break for some questions. So these mixtures exist not just sort of in the abstract, but there's actually mixtures on our food supply. This is USDA data showing that the average conventional produce item is actually contaminated with multiple pesticide residues. And many of these are organophosphates or carbamate insecticides, which again are those ones that EPA accepts as neurotoxins. Now, the organophosphates are interesting. Until a few years ago, were 35 registered organophosphate insecticides, the most common of which was chlorpyrifos. There's been a team of researchers at Columbia University who've actually been following a group of women and their babies. They started following them while they were pregnant and then continued to follow them after the babies were born. And they've got 400 mother-baby pairs that they follow. And a series of studies that they've done has shown that not only were these people exposed to organophosphates, many of which were sprayed for termites and insect control in their housing in East Harlem, but that the babies had measurable organophosphates in their meconium, or first stool. That's the first study. And when they went back and they looked at the mom's blood and urine, they found that the moms that had the highest exposures to chlorpyrifos gave birth to babies who tended to have smaller heads. And the babies with the highest exposures born to these moms were about 6 ounces lighter and about a third of an inch shorter on average. Now, this is important because birth size is actually highly correlated with cognitive ability, and also with birth outcomes. So when you have shorter, smaller babies, you get a little concerned. Now, there was kind of an interesting natural experiment because in the middle of this study, EPA started to phase out the residential or home use of these two pesticides that they were looking at, chlorpyrifos and diazinon. But they were able to continue tracking this population of women. And lo and behold, what they found was that the head circumferences increased after these pesticides were phased out for residential use. So here's some good evidence that in utero exposure to these organophosphates actually decreased head circumference and baby size, and that when you intervene, you get improvement in those parameters. Solvents. This is a study from a few years ago looking at the IQs of babies born to women who are occupationally exposed to industrial solvents. So not alcohol, but things like benzene or toluene, some of which are in cosmetics. And what they found was a rather remarkable decrease in IQ of the exposed babies of 8 points. And one of the authors described that as huge, and they said that women shouldn't be exposed while they're pregnant to these organic solvents. Again, that's the kind of data that you're seeing emerge on a daily basis. But the question, and it's probably going to indicate that what we consider now to be a safe level of exposure is going to decline. But what do we do about it? We're not able to draw all the connections between these exposures among a mixture of other exposures and learning and developmental disabilities like ADHD and autism, and yet there's some very worrisome signs in that data. So this is just a summary of what I talked about in the first half of this talk, but the exposures are widespread. just like the learning and developmental disabilities are widespread, that it can take literally decades based on our experience with lead, mercury, and PCBs before we can demonstrate proof of harm. And so the conclusion that we came to when we wrote In Harm's Way was that these early warnings that we have, the kind of warnings from animal data that are often predictive of human effects, the kind of warnings from problems at high levels of exposure, should be heeded and should inform efforts to reduce exposures at much lower levels until we can show those exposures to be safe. So this is just a picture of some of our children's environments, and because I want to keep you engaged, why don't we, is it okay, Chairman Eakin, if we have a few questions and then I'll resume?
Sure, sure. Any questions for Dr. Walenga at this point? I guess you can continue. Representative Saylor has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, you know, all this data that we've been listening to today has been talking about and fetal development and young children. I'm just curious, looking at some of the, you know, the lead poisoning, the organics, solvents, have there been any studies done on the brain impact, not causing cancer, not causing some disease, but rather on neurological problems? In either older children or working adults working in some of the factories that you were right. mentioning. I'm just wondering what you found.
What the impacts are?
Correct.
I would answer that in two ways. One, most of the early studies on those downward trend lines, most of the early studies were done in occupationally exposed adults. And that's where the first safe levels were set off of. And then it was only over time as we looked at the more sensitive exposed children populations and the in utero exposed children that the lower levels were reached. I mean, that's why those populations, pregnant women, young kids, are the ones that are now the focus of regulation. So in general, the occupational exposures do cause harm, but at higher levels than the harm caused in younger exposed populations. Now, what's interesting is now there's studies coming out looking at things like early lead exposure in life in amyloid plaques in older people. Amyloid plaques are the signature feature that you see in a microscope of somebody with Alzheimer's disease. And so it's raising questions about something I'm going to talk about a little later, which is that a lot of what we now think of as older persons' neurologic problems may actually be a reflection of their exposures to things like lead and mercury much earlier in life. But it only manifests as the brain senesces, as some of those neurons in the brain start to die off. It uncovers the earlier injuries because you don't have as much reserve capacity left in your brain.
Thank you. And Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Walenga, I look at what these toxins and farm chemicals cause, and I'm very alarmed about that, by the way. But what are the benefits, and are the corresponding benefits anywhere near is equal to the causes that they have on not only infants, but everybody else?
Mm-hmm.
I look at farm chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Are they beneficial? And is there any way that we can make them beneficial without harm?
Yeah.
That's the question that I have. What are the reasons we have farm chemicals?
Well,
and what good do they do mankind?
I think
they do the harm. What good?
I think one of the beneficial things that's happened is that the toxicity of farm chemicals over time has gotten lower. So the things like the organophosphates that I talked about, many of those were registered in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So they've been around a long time, and they were also sort of grandfathered in under FIFRA, but that's why they're the most toxic. Some of the newer things like the spot-on pesticides you put on your pets have a much safer profile, toxicity profile. What we're finding, though, at the same time, is some information now that, in addition to sort of the environmental benefits of some of the more sustainable systems of growing food, the organic systems and other sustainable systems, that in some cases the yield can actually be higher. There's less resistance, and there's other benefits as well. And this isn't a focus of this talk, but some of the nutrient concentrations in food grown without chemicals and without irrigation are actually higher than the nutritional levels in those foods when they're grown sort of conventionally and with a lot of chemicals. And then thirdly, I think we're all concerned about climate change, and there's substantial embedded carbon costs to those pesticides that are created from fossil fuels. So that's one of the benefits of what we were talking about earlier with green chemistry, is that it's moving industrial chemicals in the direction not only of using less toxic ingredients, but also using less energy. Green chemistry, in its basic principles, are new innovations in chemistry that use less energy, have less waste, and substitute safer chemical ingredients for less safe chemical ingredients. So.
Thanks. Representative Gunter.
Thank you. I certainly understand what you said. What would be the cost to the world if we didn't have the production that is increased because of many farm chemicals? And I understand and appreciate, and I'm glad it's true, that organic raised vegetables and crops are higher in nutrition, so we have to eat less of them. Maybe that would help people like me. I'd be healthier and thinner. But is there concern? I know when they say ethanol, when we divert corn to make ethanol, the price of eggs went up, so fewer people could eat eggs. And egg, to me, is one of the most perfect foods we have. Perfect protein.
I'm not sure that that's a trade-off we have to choose, fortunately. The Food and Agriculture Organization found last year that actually they were going to do more promoting of organic agriculture overseas because they found the yields were higher in organic than they were with conventional pesticide-intensive agriculture. So I don't know if that would be true in the same systems in the U.S. or not. You know, but it may be a false choice. We may be able to have high yields and reduce pesticide use at the same time. So why don't I just segue into the next session.
Okay.
I want to highlight a few things, because what I focused on in the first session is sort of where we're at with the science of what we know. And what I want to focus on is some of the emerging things that are coming up that we know even less about, and some of the lessons that we can draw from it. Ken already talked about this, that some of these chemicals that are emerging are very challenging to what we thought we knew about toxicology. And they're hormone disruptors. And that's they tend to work at very low levels in terms of their toxic effects, because hormones work at very low levels. So we have these part per billion, even part per trillion exposures that are causing effects. One of the things Ken didn't mention is that in some cases, the effects at really low levels of exposure are actually more severe than effects with moderate levels of exposure with some of these chemicals. There's not a linear dose-response relationship. You actually get higher effects at low levels, and then there might be no effect at a moderate level of exposure, and then you'd get a different kind of effect at a high level of exposure. So our whole regulatory system for these chemicals doesn't take that into account, the possibility of these strange dose-effect relationships. Another thing that's coming up is more and more information indicating the origins of adult diseases actually in these in utero exposures that Ken Cook was talking about. And this observation was made by Dr. Barker in the UK several years ago, and it was originally around how the in utero nutritional environment set the stage for later in life heart disease. But now there's evidence for in utero chemical exposures setting the stage for later disease as well, whether it's infertility or neurologic disorders. I mentioned the amyloid plaques in association with early lead. So I guess the positive side of this is that if we could figure out what an optimal environment was, an optimal learning environment, starting in the womb but also through early childhood, we may be able to have children not only with higher IQ, but adults who are not going to manifest some of these other very expensive neurologic problems later in life. So there could be a win-win. One of the third pieces of science that's quite concerning is that, you know, the old way of thinking about how toxic chemicals worked was that they overwhelmed the detoxifying enzymes in the liver, and they sort of just overwhelmed the body's natural protections. But what we're seeing with some of the hormone disruptors is that they actually change the proteins that surround genetic material, that surround DNA, and switch them on and off. Throughout our life, our DNA has to know when to switch on and off so that they can create enzymes and turn on at appropriate times for development. But some of these early hormone exposures are actually changing those on and off switches. And genes that are supposed to be off can stay on, not just now, but for years. And so I guess the flip side of this is that maybe some of the things that we think of as being a genetic disease now are actually a reflection, at least in part, of early exposures, and that if we could reduce those exposures, we might be able to reduce some of these diseases or disabilities that are thought to be genetic. And then one last thing is that these gene environments that these chemicals can contribute to, they can actually be inherited across generations in some cases. And this is based on research on particular chemicals, including vinclozolin, which is a pesticide used on soy, I think, or canola. And it was a study in animals where they found that the sperm function was affected by the vinclozolin exposure in utero to these exposed animals, and it was a decrease in sperm function that actually persisted throughout three different generations. And so this also challenges our conceptions of environmental effects as being heritable. So to me, what that makes me think of is the importance of really looking at the first environment really closely. And from environmental working groups research and other research that's come out, we now know that there's multiple contaminants in these early environments. And I think that it ought to be a goal for us as a society to try and optimize those learning environments, both in terms of nutrition, but also the absence of persistent chemicals. These are the things that different things that we know are in the womb environment. They're passed across the placenta. They include not only heavy metals, like I just talked about, but some new things too, like brominated flame retardants, like perfluorocarbons, and like some plastic additives, bisphenol A and phthalates. And these same things are being found in breast milk, so they go not only across the placenta, but across the breast milk compartment. Now, the good news is that, there's good and bad news, I guess. This is a chart showing two different kinds of what are called organohalogens. So on the bottom right, you see PCBs. So we have a really good idea about what PCBs impact is. And they were banned in 1979. And the levels in breast milk, as measured in Sweden, decreased pretty regularly. But at the same time, they started to notice in the 1990s in Sweden that these brominated flame retardants were increasing in breast milk. and they took prompt action to phase them out. And what they saw was an almost immediate, just like we saw with lead after it was taken out of gasoline, an almost immediate drop in breast milk levels of these brominated flame retardants. Now, unfortunately, the levels in American women are about 10 to 100 times higher than in European women for these chemicals. So they're off the chart on this graph. These are hormone disruptors. Industry has voluntarily gotten rid of some of the congeners, but not the DECA, which is the largest remaining brominated flame retardant. And there are other impacts that are noted, mostly in animal studies again, reproductive impacts from the hormone disruption. But there have been some suggestions that brain function is also impacted. And kids get much higher exposures to DECA than adults do. And it's thought, although we're not certain about this, that the exposure comes from breast milk and house dust. Here's another organohalogen. There seems to be something, if we look at PCBs, which are carbons and chlorine, and brominated flame retardants, which are carbons and bromine. Now we have perchlorate, which again is carbons and chlorine. There seems to be a pattern there with these organohalogens. Perchlorate can be naturally occurring, but it's also a rocket fuel ingredient. And actually, Ken didn't talk about this, but his organization's done a lot of work looking at how this rocket fuel ingredient has migrated into the food stream and is now distributed across the whole population. And one of the big concerns about it is that it actually it stops the thyroid gland from taking up iodine. The protein in the thyroid gland that actually incorporates iodine into thyroid hormone prefers perchlorate. And so when perchlorates are around, it moves perchlorate into the thyroid gland and into breast milk. So it not only decreases thyroid hormone, but it increases perchlorate exposure to the babies who are breastfeeding from women who have been exposed. And we do have some human data suggesting that women's thyroid hormone levels will drop inversely to the amount of perchlorate that they're exposed to. I'll just skip through this, but I want you to focus on this most recent study at the bottom, showing that that we know that thyroid hormone is extremely important to brain development. Okay, so the concern is that babies nursing from women exposed to perchlorate may actually be mentally impaired because of the lower thyroid hormone. They get almost all their iodine from their mothers. And so the mothers won't be giving them iodine if they're perchlorate exposed, or a lot less iodine. Perfluorocarbons is another chlorine plus fluoride organohalogen. We just heard about this. Again, it's widely present in both placenta tissue and breast milk as well. So what I'm suggesting with this is that there are mixtures of these similar kinds of chemicals, and the mixtures are in our bodies. They're also in the food supply, and we're actually introducing other nervous system toxins into the food supply as well. So it's not known very widely, but about 70% of the chickens raised in the country are given a form of arsenic called roxarsone as a growth promoter. The FDA-approved uses are actually for meat pigmentation, growth promotion, and feed efficiency. This is a practice that was begun in the 1940s, and it amounts to, it's a little hard to tell, but probably 1.7 to 2.2 million pounds a year fed to chickens. This, by the way, was never approved in Europe, so it's perfectly possible to raise chickens without any arsenic. The concern is that we know a lot about inorganic arsenic, both because it disrupts hormones and it's a carcinogen, and it's toxic to the developing brain. We don't know as much about organic arsenics like Roxarsone, but the most recent science from this year and last year shows that when you put Roxarsone in chicken feed and the chicken excretes a lot of it in manure, the bacteria in the soil actually convert that that organic arsenic into the cancer-causing form, into the inorganic form. So there's a lot of new concern about this arsenic.
Excuse me, Dr. Wallinga. Representative Dabney had a question for you.
Yes.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair, Dr. Wallinga. The obvious question, I mean, I'm intrigued with this example, since Roxarsone was or is used here and is not in Europe, have there been, I guess it would be epidemiological studies done that attempt to draw any conclusions on the health impacts between the United States and Europe on this?
Well, it's a good question. This probably isn't the major source of arsenic exposure. There's a lot of different other sources, including in Minnesota, where we've got arsenic-contaminated drinking water, and you know, there's other naturally occurring arsenic in seafood. I guess the point for talking about it here is that this is a clearly avoidable use of arsenic that will only add to the other exposures. And so it would be something that if one wanted to intervene to reduce exposure, this would be an easy place to start, because it is possible to raise chickens without it. So
that covers it.
Yeah. Thank you. And this practice is actually resulting in some detectable arsenic in chicken meat. So if you do what we did, and the FDA hasn't done, which is to go out and actually test retail chicken for arsenic, you'll find that the conventional producers are more likely to have detectable arsenic than, for example, the organic producers where it's prohibited. So not to spend too much time on that. And some other recent science on perfluorocarbons in food. Now, this hasn't gotten a lot of attention here in Minnesota, I don't think, but we know about perfluorocarbon-contaminated drinking water. We know a lot less about other kinds of perfluorinated chemicals that are used in grease-proof wrappings for food, like in popcorn bags. But a study that just came out in May of last year shows that there are 15 FDA-approved perfluorocarbons for these grease-proof wrappers, and that actually the levels at which they migrate into food could be several hundred times higher than what FDA has considered in its guidelines. And the concern from the human side is that the body may take these other kinds of perfluorinated chemicals and turn them into PFAS and PFOA within the body. So it's another route of exposure that people hadn't even really thought about. And it may in fact turn out to be one of the more important routes of exposure to PFO and PFAS. So I'm going to skip through some of that and talk about toys. Even though we know all this about lead, we continue to find lead in toys, including the, you know, the trinket that Jared Brown from Minneapolis swallowed, which killed him the year before last. That's the Reebok trinket down there on the right-hand side. And we're also have other baby products that contain these hormone-disrupting plastic additives. And I'm just going to talk briefly about bisphenol A. This is it's the building block for polycarbonate plastic, which is the clear plastic that you find in drinking water bottles like these, but also in children's baby bottles. About 95% of those polycarbonate children's baby bottles have bisphenol A in them. Now, again, this is an example of something where almost all the data is from animals, but we have several hundred studies now showing effects from its action as a hormone disruptor in exposed animals. And the effects are down to fractions of a part per trillion. So, again, exquisitely small levels. And I don't know that the effects in the developing brain are the most worrisome effects, but it's among the effects of concern. And why is that? Because estrogen is needed to masculinize the male brain in utero. Okay? So bisphenol A is a synthetic estrogen. It interferes with normal estrogen function. And there's some suggestion that bisphenol A exposure may actually affect the masculinization of exposed fetuses. And it's produced at billions of pounds per year. This is a study that came out last week where we actually went out and tested some baby bottles and found that when you heat them, as people are wont to do, or put hot liquids in them, that this bisphenol A leaches out more quickly. So, I just wanted to finish saying that I do think, as Ken Cook did, that there are things that we can do. We can think about creating better learning environments, in part by looking at these first environments. Art Rolnick of the Federal Reserve talks about how investments in early child development is a really high public return for our public dollars. And that's even without looking at, that's just looking at the social environment. What if we look at investments in reducing toxic chemicals and improving nutrition? We know from the case of lead that reducing use of it really had a big impact. So there are some opportunities here to reduce uses of specific toxins of concern that are in children's products. And these are a few that Healthy Legacy is endorsing. Now, I don't think that chemical-by-chemical approach is the be-all and end-all, though. I am concerned about basically the broken federal regulation as represented by TSCA. And a whole slew of government studies have now shown that TSCA is ineffective at controlling these industrial hazards. But I would point out, though, that the failure of TSCA doesn't just affect us as consumers, it also affects business. And that's because by not requiring safety information of chemical manufacturers, it puts all the businesses that use those chemicals in their supply chain at risk, too. Because if somebody tests a toy and they find something in the toy that they didn't expect to find there, they're going to look to the Mattels and they're going to look to the other end users of those chemicals. And so actually if we fix TSCA and start collecting safety information for these chemicals that make their way into products, it's actually going to benefit the manufacturers as well. And they'll be able to sell more easily into a global market that's increasingly wanting these safer products and safer chemical profiles. So I want to just end by pointing out that TSCA also dampens innovation by business because it doesn't reward it. It doesn't give the people in the marketplace, whether consumers or businesses, the ability to distinguish between a safer, more green-produced product and one that's not produced that way or for which we have less safety information. And so Mike Wilson in California has written very eloquently that if we reform TSCA to provide more information, it's actually going to lead to more innovation, not less. And we could even make a whole slew of things out of something other than fossil fuels, like we do with biofuels now, but we could also be making plastics out of corn or out of sugar beets or out of switchgrass even in the future. And I'm just going to end there. And want to thank you for being patient. I realize it went on fairly long, but hopefully it was worthwhile for you to hear that.
Thank you. It was very worthwhile. I appreciate your presentation. And I'd like to open it up to any questions that members may have. Representative Gunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the great presentation. Appreciate it very much. It's just the thing that's in my mind right now, why are, for example, people involved in agriculture, like my district has, why are they investing money in arsenic and stuff like that when it doesn't do anything? Because things can get worse. Do they like to spend money or what?
Well, I think I can't speak for them. I think one of the explanations is that, you know, it is legally approved by the FDA, so you can use it. I mean, it's not illegal to use it, obviously. The market makes it difficult to distinguish, for the consumer to distinguish between, in this particular case, somebody using arsenic in their chicken feed and somebody that doesn't. So I think there's a disconnect in the marketplace that's making it harder for people to distinguish between different kinds of products and how they're raised. And I think that that's a problem in the products, in the like toys and other products as well, using the analogy of chemicals in those product streams. The marketplace, determined by Tosca, doesn't really allow you to figure out in the marketplace which is a product made with a toxic chemical or without. And so we have this case of cosmetics where there's no requirement that they be labeled as to their ingredients at all. And so it's buyer beware in terms of the consumer trying to find a safer cosmetic product.
Thank you.
Thanks. And Representative Greiling had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wellinga, I'm interested, as I asked Dr. Cook as well, you know, about the possibility of linking specific harmful chemicals with specific children ending up in our K-12 system with high special ed costs. Do you think the day will ever come when we can be scientifically safe in making those links, where we could require them to pay part of the special ed costs if they're going to persist in these things? I'm cognizant of Representative Gardner's question, where he said, you know, how can we stem this tide? As soon as we tamp out one thing, two more things are invented. And so I'm thinking, if we had some incentives to not generate all these costs that they seem to get off the hook on, maybe that would be a way to get at it.
Well, I think it's unlikely that you're going to reach that point for a whole slew of reasons. I mean, one, the chemical brew that the children are being raised in is so complicated. How are you ever going to tease out the contribution of just one of those neurotoxins from the dozens or hundreds of others? I mean, scientifically, it just would be enormously complicated. And for any individual person, it's going to be especially hard. You might be able to draw some conclusions at the population level, but for individuals, it's going to be tough. Now, I think we're maybe close to that in terms of lead, but think about the investment of time and expense and energy in just trying to reach the point where we can do that on lead, something that's been around for millennia, and it's been in gas since 1925. Now, I don't think we have the patience or the resources to invest that amount of money in every one of these neurotoxins to try to draw those links. And so I think that the gist of the research that I've done, as in that Harm's Way report, is to say we shouldn't have to recreate the data that we collected for lead or for mercury or PCBs, that we've got to figure out a way to create better environments even without that data.
Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr., I keep thinking about the interaction between state regulatory processes and federal. For example, with pesticides, our Department of Agriculture, which regulates pesticides, pretty much rubber stamps EPA approval of pesticides. Would it make sense for state agencies like that to be more independent and to scrutinize these products more independently?
Well, I think that's your domain rather than mine. But
I mean, would there be something to be gained by it? From
well, I think there certainly needs to be some kind of safety evaluation that takes into account these multiple exposures, multiple pesticides, and also the populations that are going to be exposed. You know, I would point out that I gave you that slide from East Harlem just to show that, you know, a lot of pesticide exposures are from agriculture use, but there are some other very important exposures that have occurred in a residential setting or from cosmetic uses on lawns.
Mm-hmm.
And those are certainly also worthy of addressing. Thank you.
And Representative Kelsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wallinger, I'm kind of curious if you have an opinion. I mean, you talked about the USDA testing of the pesticides in vegetables and fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had the lead testing for years, and we know what the Department of Ag tests or doesn't test. But you say the FDA does not test arsenic used as a food additive in the production of chicken.
Right.
Is there some reason that the FDA doesn't test that, or is there some reason the USDA doesn't test that?
Well, their reasoning, I think, at least as best as I can tell, what they've done historically is to test chicken livers, because liver is the detoxifying organ, and their reasoning seemed to be that if the level found in liver was violative of the federal standard, which is 500 parts per billion, then they would act, and that the levels in the meat that people actually eat, because I don't eat liver, and I dare say most of us probably don't, that the levels in the meat that people actually eat would probably be lower than in the liver. So, you know, there is some rationale to that, except for the fact that it doesn't give the consumer any information about the meat that they're actually eating. It also is a very old standard, and it doesn't take into account both the multiple ways in which we're exposed to arsenic and all the recent data showing that arsenic has low-level effects. And if that information were taken into account, I think the standard might very well be lower.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you for coming. I see your slide talks about brain food and good fats, and I know that we all need to spend some more time on that, good foods for kids. And when I grew up, everybody said that fish was brain food, but nobody ever said nuts or avocados or olives were brain food, and I don't think most moms know that these are good things for kids, good fats. And I think that we need to do something in our schools. To be talking about nutrition, I mean, I have been taken, for example, with children of color who may be not drinking enough milk, and perhaps that is why lead affects them more, because it's getting in to their bodies. We need to know more too about what's good for kids.
Mm-hmm.
We know a lot about what's bad, and I know that's a conversation for another time, but I hope that our committees can do that. So I just appreciate your coming and really appreciate Mr. Cook coming. This is good for us to wrestle with.
I didn't go into it, but I did just want to draw your attention to the slide showing that really food is an important part of the equation for a couple of reasons, and you know, it all should be viewed in the context of which that It's not typical for kids in our schools to eat healthy food. And that's not my conclusion. That's healthy eating research at the University of Minnesota. And that if you compare, and Americans in general don't eat a healthy diet. You know, we under-consume these healthy fats and whole grains and fruits and vegetables by a huge amount. And we over-consume other foods that are less healthy. So I do think that you're right that this interaction going on between diet and chemicals is really important, but also just in the very early stages of people looking at it. I think the way I like to think about it is that there could be a co-benefit if we had kids on a healthier diet. It could help them in terms of detoxifying some of the chemical exposures that they're having, because we know that one of the key pathways in the liver to detoxify is oxidative pathway, and antioxidants are in fruits and vegetables. So if we eat more fruits and vegetables, we have more antioxidant ability.
Besides, nuts and avocados and good olives are great.
There you go, too.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions at all? Well, again, I would like to thank you for coming as well. I think some very thought-provoking presentations that were made here today, and I think that it's important that we do more research. There's no fear in gathering information. We shouldn't fear that at all. One concern that I have is at the state level, I think obviously it's going to take national initiatives to really create a policy, the general policy that you were speaking of and Mr. Cook was speaking of, to encourage the type of research into safer chemicals for a more green form of chemistry. We can, I think, at the state level obviously do more to research and develop these things at the university and so on, but I think we're more limited in pushing the private sector into doing that, because obviously these are chemical companies that are national in scope. We don't have as much influence in the market as the national government does. You had a comment?
Well, I actually think that that's only partially the case, perhaps. I'm aware of the example in Massachusetts where for several years they've been invested in a process of trying to identify categories of chemicals of greatest concern and targeting those for action. And so they're not waiting for federal reform. They're actually proactively trying to target things. And one can think about what those categories might be. They're the most persistent chemicals, the persistent organic pollutants. There may be things that are known carcinogens or reproductive toxins or neurotoxins. There are things that are likely to be found in breast milk or in fetal blood, for example. So I think there is, and I haven't gone into it, but I know that I've had a hand in developing something called the green screen, which is a regimented way for thinking through what some of these categories of high concern chemicals are that could be substituted with safer alternatives. So I think states could do that and maybe should do that.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with that, Dr. Walenga, and that's a good point. But again, you know, you run into the problem that Representative Gardner was talking about. When you ban certain chemicals, it could result in other chemicals that have other problems, and we could maybe come up with some safe alternatives. But as far as developing a general policy, I think that more pressure needs to be placed on the federal government in order to develop that and to steer the chemical industry, for instance, into a more green chemistry. I actually prefer a different term, maybe something like human-centered chemistry or something, so it makes it clear that this is about our kids, this is about human beings that we're talking about here. And I think, you know, we can do a lot at the state level, maybe in the research and maybe banning certain chemicals, but I think that are determined to be dangerous. But as far as the general policy, again, I think we're going to have to see more action on the federal level. So I don't know if anybody else has any comments or questions, and very valuable information today. Appreciate your time. So, thank you. Meeting adjourned.